right. Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. We are back again on the air with our Connecting the Dots podcast, talking about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And today, we've got our dear old friend of the show, Deacon Stephen Gradonis, speaking to the deacon. He's way over there in New Jersey, and I'm way over here in Seattle. But thanks to the miracle of technology, we are talking to each other. How you doing there, Steve?
I'm good. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Yeah, it's a brand new year. We've got a crop of lots of movies already out that we didn't have a chance to talk about, as well as it's an interesting cultural phenomena taking place right now with things like the Me Too movement making itself felt and heard at the Golden Globes earlier this week. I thought it'd be interesting to talk about that a little bit, because I think that it's an important kind of a watershed going on right now as a result of this odd little meme that just popped up on the internet and just... It was just a watershed moment, and I think it's an important one for us.
So, yeah, it's a very important moment. It's a moment of really remarkable historical significance, and there are a lot of people passionately committed to the Me Too movement and who hope that we're at the point of a radical transformation in society. There are people who are poo-pooing all of this and heaping a great deal of skepticism on it, saying this is just a bunch of self-righteous Hollywood celebrities pointing their fingers at the rest of the world. There are people heaping a great deal of skepticism on the women accusing powerful men in Hollywood and elsewhere. Right. We saw a lot of that late last year with Judge Roy Moore.
Right.
And, you know, and we're, you know, so people are saying things like, well, why did it take these women so long to come forward with their stories? Why, Mark?
why would it take them forever to come forward with their stories when they come forward and they're called liars immediately?
So, yeah. I mean, one of the things that I have learned as a fairly normal, average, heterosexual, middle-class white male is that there are people in the world who have experiences different from me.
You don't
and say. I've learned this.
And, okay.
And good. When I listen to people who are different from me, I learn things about the world that I wouldn't have known any other way.
How about that?
Yes.
Yeah.
This is, and what I've found is that women have a lot of experiences that men don't have and that men don't know that are such a large part of the experience of being a woman in the world.
Right. It was – I got to tell you, I mean, I feel like an idiot, you know, but I really was gobsmacked by Me Too. I was astonished at – I watched the way it proliferated simply on my own Facebook page, which admittedly, I mean, you know, there's like, I have 5,000 people who are friended on my Facebook page, which is a lot of people, but it's still just a teeny tiny slice of American life. And I was astonished at the number of women who came forward saying Me Too, that they'd been, you know, that it is the norm for women to be sexually harassed, and sometimes more than sexually harassed, sexually assaulted and all the rest of it. And I finally had to respond and say, I really had no idea. You know, I was raised in a house of nothing but men except for my mother. You know, you heard stories like my mother-in-law used to tell a story, which, because I assumed it was rare and because she carried herself with such class and grace, I kind of thought, well, I guess, you know, this is a tiny minority of experience for women. She used to tell a story about, being on a subway in New York and feeling a hand, so it was really packed, and feeling this hand sort of, you know, groping around. And so she made her best guess about whose hand it belonged to and which foot near hers was his. And then she put the spike of her high heel on the arch of that foot and bore down with all of her weight, and the hand went and disappeared. You know, it was one of those stories where you thought, ha ha, you know, New York City gal, you know, she knew how to handle herself. But you start realizing this is not uncommon.
No.
And she's, you know, she told other stories about, you know, being at dances and being threatened with a knife by some guy, you know, who came up to her, who mm-hmm. wanted to dance, and he waved a knife in her face. And again, you know, being a New York City gal, she said, oh, go away. And the guy, you know, backed down and disappeared. But, you know, that's not supposed to happen. And this is the normative experience for women.
It really is. You know, I was at a party many years ago, almost 20 years ago now, and I discovered that a number of women had all been groped by a man who was in the room. And this was apparently something that this, you know, this guy did regularly. And it only takes one guy for that to happen to a lot of women. And it's not just one guy, and it's not always groping, but it can be many things, you know. Yeah. I heard a story just the other day about a woman who was walking her dog in New York City, and a guy approached her, and he seemed friendly. And, you know, then he began asking her weird questions about, did she live in the neighborhood, and, you know, things that made her, you know, realize that things that made her feel afraid and uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And it wound up getting even creepier than that. Mm-hmm. So one of the most harsh and most basic realities of human existence is that throughout all of human history, powerful men, and even not necessarily powerful men, have taken varying kinds of sexual license with women, with right. children, with men, and far more often than not, they've gotten away with it. Right. In fact, in the vast majority of cases, the victim never publicly accuses her or his attacker. Right. They don't tell anyone. Maybe they tell one close confidant or a small number of people, and you know, nothing ever comes out and nothing ever happens. And this is, in fact, so common that it's practically certain that everyone listening to this podcast right now, you know, either is such a person mm-hmm. or they know such people, probably more than one, relatives or people that they're close to, who have been sexually assaulted and never told anyone, or maybe told right. one or two people. And there are all kinds of reasons why this happens. So, you know, what's really remarkable about the cultural moment that we're in right now is not that after, you know, years and decades of silence, women are coming forward, and why did they wait so long? What's really remarkable is that they are coming forward.
Yeah.
And that finally the world is ready to hear them and ready in some cases to hold responsible the powerful men that they're accusing.
Right. Yeah. And that was, you know, that was the significance of the Golden Globes. I've been thinking about this because, you know, one of the things that the Christian tradition speaks about, of course, very much is the call to repentance. And there are certain things that go with repentance. So, you know, contrition, a firm purpose of amendment, and that sort of thing. But another thing that the Christian tradition warns goes with the phenomenon of repentance, with the reality of repentance, is accusation for repented sins. So this is something, for example, that St. Paul has to cope with. St. Paul is sincerely repentant for his sins, but, you know, that doesn't really help him with the Christian community when things first start out. They don't want to have anything to do with him. Because, you know, look at all this stuff that you did. Yeah, sure, you say that you're a Christian now, but we don't trust you at all. And, you know, this is complicated as well by the fact that not everybody who makes a movement toward repentance does it perfectly because of, you know, all kinds of reasons, right? You're embarrassed about what you did, or you're complicit in what the Christian tradition calls a structure of sin. So, for example, you know, you see the example of people like Thomas Jefferson, who seems to have sincerely hated slavery, but never freed his slaves.
Right.
You know, so you get those kind of, what can you call it, half-assed movements toward repentance, right? And you get people who, you know, because of economic reasons, because of power structure reasons, are complicit in all kinds of things that they themselves sincerely hate sometimes, you know, but don't know what to do about. So immediately, you know, at the Golden Globes, Oprah Winfrey gave what I thought was a barn burner of a speech.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was terrific. I thought it was deeply informed by the Christian tradition too. And at the practically before she was done talking, of course, what people immediately did was they started putting up pictures of her, you know, chumming around with Harvey Weinstein. Right.
Right.
And the implication, of course, is everything that she just said is worthless because she has been part of this power structure that exists in Hollywood, where powerful men like Weinstein have for years taken advantage of their power to beat people up and rape them and do weird, creepy things. And you know,
let's be very clear about that, because only just today on Facebook, I had somebody challenge me and say, maybe we shouldn't be so quick to believe the accusations against Weinstein.
Right.
and so I want to be clear. We're talking about a man who has had literally scores of accusations against him, who went out of his way to destroy the careers of actresses who crossed him or who resisted him, who literally hired ex-Mossad agents from Israel to run interference against women who wanted to make accusations against him. We're talking about someone who is just a psychopath, who's remorseless, who's just a monster, who, you know, and not everyone who's guilty in this area is as bad as Weinstein, but Weinstein is really as bad as you get.
Right, right. And so, you know, the people, and I've seen, you know, comparable kinds of questions, you know, asked about, I'll get back to that in a minute, but, you know, you see something like that and people say, well, why didn't, you know, Oprah Winfrey challenge somebody like Weinstein? Well, you know,
because maybe he didn't do anything to her.
Maybe he didn't do anything to her. You know, even if she, I mean, it's an assumption that just because she sat next to him, somehow or other, she's aware of this. But let's just suppose that she was aware of this. What's she supposed to do exactly 20, 25 years ago? How? This is an enormously complex problem. And when people push back, one of the things that immediately happens when you push back against a structure of sin, especially one that you may have been complicit in, is the accuser begins.
Yes.
Ah, you're a liar. You're just, you know, everything you have to say is worthless, and you can never get out of this structure of sin that you've been complicit in because you were complicit in it. And, you know, this is... I think that this is incredibly toxic, and so, you know, I look at what Winfrey said, and I said, this is great, good for her, you know, and yes, maybe she's been complicit in the structure of sin, but she's pushing back against it now. So, are you going to get on board and help push with her, or are you going to try and pull her back in? And this brings me to, since we're talking about movies, there are, you know, fictional stories that show this kind of moral struggle against structures of sin. I think the perhaps the greatest cinematic portrayal of somebody who tries to push back against a structure of sin and winds up getting sucked into it and destroyed by it is the Godfather series. This is about. This is a story of damnation. I try to get out and they pull me back in, says Michael. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about structures of sin. The church talks about this concept of structures of sin. The classic example, the biblical example that I use to point to this, to what the church means by a structure of sin, is the story of Paul and the silversmiths. So Paul goes to Ephesus and begins to preach the gospel there. And as the gospel begins to spread, of course, the gospel constitutes a threat not merely to our individual sins and that sort of thing. It constitutes in Ephesus a threat to a religious cult, the cult of Diana, that's centered around the Temple of Diana. But the cult of Diana wasn't just a religious cult. It's a business. So you've got silversmiths who, that's what they do all day, is they make little idols of Diana to sell as trinkets at the Temple of Diana. That's how they make their living. So the gospel pushes back not merely against our individual sins, but it also pushes back against an entire structure of sin that has been built around, in this case, the cult of Diana. And we do that all the time. So the gospel constituted a colossal threat to a huge structure of sin called slavery in the United States before the Civil War. And it still constitutes today, you know, a threat to all kinds of structures of sin, including, of course, the structure of sin surrounding sexual harassment, sexual assault, and all the rest of it.
Which is certainly, we've seen in a very dramatic way, just how embedded it's been in Hollywood culture. But we've also seen the Me Too movement break out of that culture and break into other sectors, other industries, other parts of the country. We've seen it in Washington, D.C. and in New York and all over the place. And there is something going on here.
Right.
That is more than just, you know, posturing or self-righteousness. And it's going to be very interesting to see where this movement continues to go.
Right. And, you know, and it's interesting for a number of reasons, as you mentioned. I think in many ways it can be argued that the founder of the Me Too movement was Donald Trump. Now, that's unfair, of course, to the people who really literally started the Me Too movement, the women who started the Me Too movement. But he was, in many ways, he's a catalyst for it. But what's also interesting.
It's really true that he did give a kind of impetus to it. He drove enough people sufficiently crazy with the state of the world that someone like him with so many accusations against him that he wasn't finished off. I mean, we saw over and over so many things that under normal circumstances you would think would have finished a politician off, and it put people at a point where they realized this thing that happened to me or that I know about, I can't be silent about this anymore.
Right, exactly. And so there's that. And there is, of course, you know, there remains, because that's the nature of structures of sin. There remains, for example, in Hollywood, as I've been fond of saying for some years now, one of the things that Roman Polanski has demonstrated is that if you want to sexually molest a child, you just have to be the right sort of Roman. And that's still true. I mean, he's gotten a pass. Woody Allen has gotten a pass. And there are others, of course.
The Roman Polanski case is, you know, it's always been controversial in Hollywood. There have always been anti-Roman people as well as defenders. Woody Allen is also a complicated case. Alyssa Wilkinson of Vox formerly of Christianity Today, has a really good article on Woody Allen right now, talking about some of the reasons why he's been able to get away with it for so long. The chief one being that there's one accuser. That makes his case a little different from somebody like Weinstein, who has over 80 people accusing him.
Right.
Or Bill Cosby.
Bill Cosby. Another example. 50 guy or 50 women, you know.
Right.
Accusing him.
Kind of a precursor. And what happens in these cases is that when one woman is able to speak up and to get attention and to make to at least give the charge some credibility, then that encourages other women to speak up. And so you get a kind of a snowball effect. And what we've seen here is the snowball turning into an avalanche in a way that is, I think, historically unprecedented. I don't think we've ever in human history seen anything like this. And
it really is. Yeah, it's remarkable. There has been, I think, a real sea change has happened. And I don't think I don't think that this is kind of a 9-day wonder and then it'll be back to business as usual. I think that women have taken a hold of their power in this particular situation, and that it's gonna spread. It's not gonna shrink or go away.
No, which is not to say, you know, that in 2018 we're going to see a perfectly egalitarian society where men and women are treated equally and, you know, sexual harassment isn't tolerated. Men have held enough power for long enough that they've been able to protect themselves for a long, long time. And I think we're going to see an ebbing of that, but I don't think it's going to disappear. Somewhat like, you know, you think of the civil rights movement. Think of the battle against racism and civil rights in the 1960s. We've certainly come a long way since the 1960s, but that you know, certainly doesn't mean that society has been completely transformed and now racism is no longer an issue. That's made very clear to us.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the things that I've been remarking on recently has simply been the fact that I really believe in my heart and in my guts, in the myth of progress. And I know in my head that it's not true. I know when I say the myth of progress, what I mean is that progress is automatic, and once achieved, you can never lose it.
Right. No.
That's a total myth, and the proof of that, of course, is, you know, when I grew up. You know, I grew up in the period after which people like Martin Luther King were, you know, revered, you know, national. We're going to celebrate a national holiday in his honor on Monday, you know, and I took it for granted that the gains made by the civil rights movement were, of course, okay, that's it. We've achieved that level, achievement level unlocked. and we're not going to go back on that now. And yet last year we had people marching under the banner of the swastika and the president of the United States saying that they're very fine people, while black men knelt peacefully on a football field and were called by that same president sons of bitches. That's a step backwards, you know. I recognize that it's possible for us to lose gains, and this is the lesson of history, of course. You know, the Roman Empire grows and flourishes, and then Rome winds up as a, you know, practically a cow pasture again for a long time, you know. And you know, Russia goes from Peter the Great to Stalin the Monster. You know, Hitler goes or Germany goes from Goethe and Bach to Hitler. It is possible for a civilization to really lose its mind. And so these gains that are being made in the Me Too movement, don't take them for granted, is what I'm saying.
No. Yes.
Because they can be lost again.
You know, and you raised the point about the accuser, about the system lashing out to protect itself and to discredit those who are pushing for change. And I think of, you know, the backlash against the Golden Globes in those black dresses, you know, and there was a meme circulating on in cyberspace showing women in black dresses that were extremely revealing and
right.
with, you know, comments about how, you know, they're objectifying themselves and they're obviously hypocrites and so forth. Mm-hmm. And the women in the meme actually weren't from the 2018 Golden Globes. They were from other events. They were from other things.
Right.
None of that mattered, though, because the point is that here are women, and many of them, so some of them perhaps just jumping on the bandwagon. I have no doubt. There are people in Hollywood, just like there are people anywhere else, who just want to be seen to be mouthing the appropriate pieties.
Sure.
And their commitment is shallow. But at the same time, you know, people in Hollywood, they really are not another species. They're not some simulacra of humanity. They're just yeah. people who decided that they wanted to work in this particular industry. They're really, really just like everyone else. And you know, and so there are very sincere and passionate women in Hollywood who have been concerned about this issue for a long time. And some of them were wearing black dresses, and some of them, you know, it was very nice, very presentable, very modest black dresses. And, you know, sincerely standing up on this issue. But it becomes necessary to try to degrade them and to take them down and to slur right. them and accuse them, because that's how the system protects itself.
Right. And that's really what it comes back to, is if you're angry at Oprah Winfrey for giving a speech where she, you know, brought the house down in condemnation of sexual harassment and sexual predators, my question to you is, why? Is that a bad thing to be opposed to? And why do you think so? You know, and that's really what it comes back to for me, is so what's the goal here? Is the goal to bring about some change where change is obviously needed, or is it to maintain the status quo?
I think part of the status quo that people really want to maintain is their neat little dichotomies of us versus them. We're the good people, they're the bad people. We're the moral heartland, they're immoral, liberal, media elite Hollywood. And so we can't make any common cause with them because they're literally the devil. And yeah. so everything that they say and do is bad by definition, and
right.
they're always in bad faith. We can never take anything that they say seriously, you know, morally at face value.
Right.
And people on all sides of all kinds of tribal divides make the same mistake.
Right.
You know, it's so, you know, Sarah Silverman reached out to a troll who called her an obscene name on Twitter. And she made a kind gesture to him and, you know, got him, you know, connected him with some people in his community who could help him with problems that he had. It was an amazing thing that she did.
Yeah.
Sarah Silverman is, you know, and I could write a Facebook post a week about Sarah Silverman, and I could find something to disagree with Sarah Silverman about every day of the week if I so chose.
Right.
But here she is doing something good. And why are you going to tear that down because, you know, you have some other disagreement with her or some other criticism of her as a human being?
Right. And she's done, you know, she's done other things that I think have been quite remarkable. And this is something that I think is it's a misnomer to use words like charism to describe non-baptized people, because charisms technically mm-hmm. are attached to baptism. But I do think that you could describe it as a kind of a charism of the Jewish people in particular, to be acutely aware of the fact that when a society is starting to come apart, it's going to be the least of these that get it in the neck first. And the least of these are very often Jews themselves. And so one of the things that she seems to be intuiting is that the U.S. is coming apart. So she started this show on Hulu, basically, where she goes around and she, among other things, deliberately talks to people who she radically disagrees with on a bunch of stuff to try to understand them better. And she also features things that people are doing well. And so she did this interview with Father Greg Boyle. He runs something called Homeboy Ministries. He works with the street kids and gangs and so forth in L.A., helping them to get jobs, helping them to, you know, find their feet. Did this very, you know, respectful, great interview with this guy with whom she has very little in common, a Catholic priest. And she's, you know, she's done her share of making fun of Christians and Catholics and so on and the rest of it. But she sees that this guy is working toward the common good and wanted to hold him up for view to her audience of people who chances are don't have a lot of empathy for the Catholic Church. But she saw real good things happening here. And so she highlighted it. And I've got nothing but respect for her for doing that. So
what you're saying reminds me of something that I saw on Twitter this week from a writer named Nicole Cliff, formerly of The Toast. She writes for Vulture and Elle, and she has apparently she's apparently a somewhat new Christian.
Okay.
And she writes on Twitter, "I'm often asked by other Christians if people," and she's from a liberal perspective politically. Mm-hmm. She says, "I'm often asked by other Christians if people have been jerks to me about becoming a Christian." And it's like, nah, son, it's like the most popular religion in the United States. It's been fine. And she goes on to talk about, you know, the sword that Jesus brings into the world and having to sometimes have uncomfortable and challenging conversations with people. And she says, "You're going to have people who are recovering from straight up spiritual abuse and people who think it's just dumb and people who think you are. And if you can't have these conversations, then the problem isn't your friends." But then she says something very interesting. She says that people are also going to worry that whatever has happened to you is also what the moral majority has wrought in the nation's politics.
Right.
And she sums up something I think that is really essential for us as conscientious objectors to that style of Christian politics. She says, I'm not going to use the exact word that she uses, but she says, "Christians can engage in some really bad stuff, mm-hmm. and there's no point in no true Scotsmaning them. These mm-hmm. horrible people are real Christians too.
Right.
And you need to engage with the reputation damage and with the bad theology." I think that that's a very important bit of complexity in this, you know, polemic of culture wars and of tribalism, that, you know, the people who were in many ways pitted against and fighting against for the soul of Christianity in America, they're affected by some really bad aspects of structures of sin and you know, sin that's endemic in the culture, but they're also our brothers and sisters.
Yes.
And like Sarah Silverman with that obscene guy, we need to recognize that. We need to find ways of trying to be constructive there.
Yeah. Well, let's move on, because I thought it was worth talking about the whole Golden Globes thing. But yeah. I want to talk about the movies.
Okay.
Seen any good movies lately?
Well, I am publishing my 2017 list of my top films of the year. And you can read that. You can look at that. You can find it right now on decentfilms.com and the National Catholic Register website.
Cool.
And, you know, 2016 was a terrible year for Hollywood. You know, worst box office ticket sales domestically in the past quarter century. And
really?
And so, yeah, yeah. And okay. 1992 was the last year that it was this bad.
Okay.
There were a lot of obviously big ticket flops at the box office, movies like Justice League and Tom Cruise's The Mummy and so forth. And while there were also some big movies that were popular that I thought were actually good, as a lot of the movies on my best of films list are going to be movies that most people have never heard of.
Okay. So, but surely, I mean, you regard The Last Jedi as the greatest film ever made, right?
So let's talk about The Last Jedi, because I know you saw that one.
I did. Well, and I saw Dunkirk and I saw War for the Planet of the Apes, which, by the way, I thought War for the Planet of the Apes was really good. But
Have you seen the whole trilogy?
I have.
Yeah, okay.
The
So,
naming of the trilogy is extremely weird to me and impossible to follow,
yes.
but I thought War for the Planet of the Apes was good. But anyway, Last Jedi, we'll talk about that first because we haven't talked about.
Okay.
Okay. So go for it. Give me your
Well,
opinion.
you start. It's your show.
Well, I enjoyed it. I'm much more patient with middle movies and trilogies than I think other people seem to be. People have just been freaking about the, well, it feels all weird and unresolved. I'm going, well, of course, it's the second act in a third act story, in a three act story. Of course, it feels weird and unresolved. But I can live with that, you know. The other thing that people seem to be terribly upset about, which honest to God did not even occur to me while I was watching the film, was all the it's nothing but strong women characters. All the male characters are weak and dumb. And I was like, okay, I really it didn't register with me, and I don't know what that says about me.
Okay.
But I just didn't care about that. I still like Finn. I think he's a strong character, and I seem to be the only person, including Mark Hamill, who doesn't mind what they did with Luke's character all that much. Anyway, that's kind of my take on it. I want to see how Rian Johnson resolves it in the third film, and then we can go back and revisit it. It may be one of those things where, like you say, you know, the conclusion makes everything that went before worse instead of better, you know. But I'm waiting to see what Rian Johnson does. So that's my take.
So actually, it's not going to be Rian Johnson. It's
Oh,
going
it's
to be
not.
J.J. Abrams.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I thought it was.
we're going by who did Episode 7, the Force Awakens. So yeah, at this point, I find myself watching the Star Wars movies a little bit like I watched the Marvel movies, enjoying the individual set pieces for what they are, and not necessarily expecting it to add up to anything more than that, which I think for Star Wars is a problem. I think probably my biggest problem with The Last Jedi is that when I try to put it together with The Force Awakens, it seems very clear to me that there's no coherent vision for what this franchise is supposed to be. The Force Awakens laid out these clues and mysteries and puzzles. It gives us a mysterious, somewhat emperor-like villain in this hologram of Snoke, and who is he, and where does he fit in, and how is he? What's his relationship with Kylo Ren and so forth? And okay, there's going to be spoilers here. This is totally spoiler, non-spoiler
That's
free
been a
show.
month. We can.
So okay, never mind. Just cut him in half and get rid of him, and that's the end of Snoke.
Okay, admittedly, that was a problem for me too. It's like, wait, you're supposed to read his mind and you don't know that he's about to cut you in half, you dummy?
Well, he's supposed to. He tricked him by he was thinking funny at him, something like that. So, okay,
Sure.
so Rey is a character who lives on this desert planet, and her family is conspicuously missing, and she's crazy strong in the Force. And then when she goes to this hive of scum and villainy, something in the basement calls out to her, and it's Luke Skywalker's lightsaber. It's like she's got some kind of connection to him. And the other extremely powerful Force guy is descended from Princess Leia. So what does this? Okay, no, Rey, she's nobody from nowhere. Her parents weren't anyone, and it doesn't matter. Which, again, I have no problem with the idea that Rey doesn't come from anywhere, but it's going to, when you watch these films together, you're going to be frustrated and impatient watching The Force Awakens because you know what's coming and you feel like you're being set up.
Well, of course, so, all of that assumes that Kylo Ren isn't just lying to her.
But you know, the bad guys in Star Wars never lie. They never lie. I mean, Rian Johnson can decide next time out that she was lying, but then we're going to have to come up with an explanation for why he was lying and why that's satisfying when we go back and we watch this movie. But you know, this is if it's true that he's just lying, then that makes The Force Awakens even more inconsequential, because to the extent that the first movie, the Force Awakens, was analogous to the original Star Wars, and it's really, really analogous. This movie is analogous in many respects to The Empire Strikes Back with elements of Return of the Jedi. And so Your Nobody from Nowhere is like this movie's equivalent to I Am Your Father. If it's a lie, then we have an even less consequential movie on our hands.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, but you know, I'm not going to let you kill it for me, Steve.
That's okay. I would never take away anybody's wholesome pleasure in any movie, no matter how dumb I think it is.
You know what I did enjoy and was very grateful for the introduction of her character was I really liked Rose. I loved her, and I loved that after she rescues Finn from his kamikaze act, she says, you know, the way we win is not by killing what we hate, but by saving what we love. I thought that's
Holda just save the people she loved precisely by sacrificing herself in a kamikaze act just like that and destroying what she hated? I mean, she literally, the Laura Dern character, she literally does exactly the same thing that Finn is doing, but because she's a wise woman, it's okay for her, and Finn is just a dumb male, and so he needs to be saved by Rose.
Okay.
Although I don't want to take it away from you.
I got to say, you know, the whole jumping to light speed and
it's really cool.
It was super cool. And it was especially cool because they just cut all the sound out.
Yes.
It was super cool. That was great filmmaking, you know. But yeah, okay, fine.
It was. And of course, that's going to raise questions when we go back and we watch the original Star Wars and you realize that, you know, setting even a fairly small ship to light speed and setting it on automatic. If you were to ram the Death Star with that, you know, like you could take out the Death Star with the Millennium Falcon, right?
Yeah, I suppose you could. That would have been super cool too. But unfortunately, it would have killed all the principles in the whole film. So you don't want to do that either. But I don't know. I'm willing to wait and see how it resolves, and maybe it will resolve in some great way. We'll see. Although I got to say, if J.J. Abrams is making it, my hopes are not up because he made Lost, which racked up so many narrative debts that it never paid off that I was just it drove me nuts. You know, there
that's
was
exactly,
a million lessons that he
right.
did.
That's exactly what I fear here is the idea that every one of these movies is going to write checks and they're never going to get paid.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Let's move on to War for the Planet of the Apes.
All right, let's do that.
Because I think that the new Planet of the Apes trilogy is the smartest and the most morally resonant active Hollywood franchise.
Yeah, and biblically resonant too.
Oh man, the biblical imagery and themes in this movie. You've got the Old Testament, you've got the New Testament, you've got Moses and the Exodus, you've got the flood, you've got the crucifixion. It goes on and on. And then of course you've also got World War II, you know, all kinds of things going on.
Yeah. I really, really liked it. My son Peter was just like, gobsmacked when it was over. He'd never seen anything that powerful. And it was so satisfying to go to a movie with somebody else who really felt the power of what a good movie can do. And so, yeah, I would recommend anybody to watch this most recent Planet of the Apes trilogy.
But I think you have to watch all three.
Yeah.
You can't just watch this one in isolation.
No.
If you did, I could understand. I could easily understand someone coming away from this movie and saying, this movie is anti-human. It's anti-American. It's anti-religious. You know, all of the human beings in this movie, except for Nova, who kind of sort of doesn't count, are bad. And, you know, the bad guy is this epitome of, like, the white skinhead, religious maniac, military American guy, you know, the Star Spangled Banner and cruelty to animals, all of this stuff. But if you watch the whole trilogy, all of this is seen in a very different light. Let me just lay it out as quickly.
Okay.
So the first film, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which comes before the Dawn.
which makes no sense.
It makes no sense. I have to say, I got to the end of the movie and I said to myself, well, what's the subtext here? What is this movie about? You know, we see James Franco as a scientist. He's concerned with trying to cure Alzheimer's, and through various circumstances, it leads to the beginnings of a race of super intelligent apes, but also to the decimation of humanity. But it's not a story of science, you know, of the scientific hubris or anything like that. There doesn't seem to be any. It felt to me like the filmmakers weren't asking any question other than how can we launch a semi-plausible Planet of the Apes franchise. And they answered that question pretty smartly, but it didn't feel to me like there was anything else there. And that left me with the queasy feeling that maybe this is going to be a kind of post-human porn, kind of a, you know, cheering for the downfall of humanity because people are bad or something like that. But the second film in the franchise, which had a new director, Matt Reeves, this is Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, completely blew me away because it sets us up with two communities, a human community and an ape community. And what we see is that there are individuals on both sides who are warily desirous of avoiding conflict with the other, who are trying to work toward a situation where they can coexist peacefully with each other. And then there are also individuals on both sides who distrust the other so much that they want to, you know, burn the bridges that the first people are trying to build. So it's not like, you know, apes good and humans bad. It's bridge builders good and bridge burners bad. But the movie also makes the painfully poignant observation that the people burning bridges have an advantage. It's easier to burn bridges than it is to build them.
Yeah.
So in this movie, it's no longer an even story of two communities. It's a story about this community of apes. And the only piece of humanity that we see is this rogue military outfit led by a maniac who has killed all of the men who didn't agree with his maniac ways. He's kind of like a breakaway militia group or something. The rest of the army is coming to get him, we learn. So he clearly does not represent humanity in any way, shape, or form. And if you think about the culture that exists right now in this country, if there were a guy like that, what kind of symbols and associations is he going to take to himself?
It would absolutely be the stars and stripes and the cross.
This is exactly what he is, the epitome of what a character like. And it's not in any way, shape, or form saying this is the truth about American patriotism and the military and religion. It's saying in a situation where you have a maniac like this, he's going to wrap himself in the flag and he's going to put a cross around his neck. That's what he's going to do.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, getting on to the biblical imagery.
Yes.
This, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is the Exodus. It draws so much on scripture all over the place, and the heroic aspects of it are all affirming scriptural truths.
Yes.
You know, so the self-sacrifice and the willingness to, you know, to try to redeem the time and the offering of sacrificial suffering for one's people, and
the destructiveness of revenge.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the things that's really, I mean, you have a certain Moses and Joshua passing of the baton in the movie, but there's also a little bit of David and Solomon. David was not allowed to build the temple because he was a man of war. Mm-hmm. So God wanted Solomon to build the temple rather than David because David was a man of war. And in this movie, we see, you know, I said that the last film, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, shows how the line between good and evil runs through both communities. There are evil humans and evil apes, good humans and good apes. In this movie, there aren't many good humans. There's only Nova. But what we see is that line of good and evil runs through the individual. Mm-hmm. That Caesar himself, as great a leader as he's been, he has the same blackness in his heart as Koba, the bad ape from the previous film. He has that capacity for hatred and the desire for revenge. This is something, by the way, that links the film to Darren Aronofsky's Noah, because Noah also comes to that same realization that sin dwells in his own heart. And so even if God wipes out the rest of humanity, how is that going to solve the problem? It's just going to start over again.
Right.
And so there's a sense in which at the end, when the baton is passed from Caesar to Maurice, the gentle orangutan, that this is a kind of a passing of the torch from a David who could lead his people so far and no farther to someone who is more peaceful and who doesn't have that, perhaps not some of the great leadership qualities that made Caesar able to do what he did, but also with them that capacity and that desire for hatred and revenge.
Yeah, yeah. Before we go, I wanted to talk about one last film just because I thought it was a really good film. Dunkirk.
Yes, my number three film of 2017.
Very good. Really. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. It reminded me, it's another Christopher Nolan film, and therefore reminded me of other Christopher Nolan films in particular. And this may be an odd connection, but I thought the structure of it very much reminded me of Memento.
Yeah, well, Nolan has always had that kind of interest in crisscrossing time narratives, and what he does here with his three different narrative frameworks unspooling in very different rates of time,
right,
but all given equal narrative weight. It is reminiscent of Memento and of Inception and other time-bending films that Nolan has explored. But what he does with this kind of triptych structure, he's able to transcend some of the things that have, I think, kind of held him back in other films. For one thing, one of the recurring themes in all of Nolan's films is the necessity of a noble lie to give meaning to your endeavor, to what you're doing. There are certainly characters in this film who are dishonest, and there are lies that are told, including a lie that's told to make someone feel better. You could call that a noble lie. But at essence, the movie is about survival and solidarity, and it's about solidarity, you know, including not only soldiers, but ordinary civilians and ordinary people. And there's something very honest and straightforward about that. And the fact that Nolan was able to find in this film, you know, redemption for the common man, not just for the heroes in uniform, not just for Batman, but for the ordinary people of Gotham City, as it were. That was something this was a question that haunted him all through the Dark Knight trilogy. Are the people in Gotham City worth saving? Can they rise up and save themselves? And somehow he got to the end of the trilogy, and even though there are hints of it in the Dark Knight Rises, that question is never answered. We never get to the uprising of the ordinary people. And here we have Mark Rylance representing the civilians of England. And he's steady, and he has that kind of World War I matter of fact civic duty and virtue. And it's just, I felt like Nolan perhaps had to kind of go back in time to this historical story that gave us the phrase Dunkirk spirit. Right. To exemplify this in order to answer that question that I think has been nagging him in the past.
Yeah, and I think it is something that troubles him. You know, the one does not get the sense of a sunny outlook on life from
Have you Oh, I'm suddenly I'm blanking on it, but The Prestige. Have you seen The Prestige?
I have seen The Prestige.
Oh my, that movie is cold as ice.
Yeah, well, and that's, you know, I mean, I think of Norm Macdonald's remark that, you know, the more I learn about Hitler, the less I care for that guy. Nolan, you know, really does have a very bleak assessment of the human race, and it's heartening to me that he could look at Dunkirk and see not only people being heroic in the moment, but simply seeing people who were worth saving. Yes. And that, you know, that gives me a lot of hope. I mean, it's still suffused with still a lot of, you know, I mean, there's the survivor guilt for the people who made it back from Dunkirk and that sort of thing. And, you know, those sorts of struggles. And, you know, you look at Tom Hardy's character who, he's the pilot who winds up landing on the beach at Dunkirk and being taken prisoner by the Nazis, presumably to spend the rest of the war in some POW camp. But the overall, and it's a harrowing movie to watch, by the way.
Yes.
I mean, it's, you know, what came through sort of the legend of World War II was simply and solely the miracle of Dunkirk. It looked like it was curtains, but we got our boys off the beach and, you know, pip, pip, cheerio, well done, you know. But just the horrors that these guys went through, and just getting off the beach was not, that's not the end of the horrors. You know, your ship can No. still be torpedoed and you can still have horrific things happen to you, you know.
We have characters in this movie who get off the beach again and again and again.
Yeah,
and
multiple times.
Back on the beach.
Yeah, you know, you know, are they, yeah. I mean, it's just one thing after another happens to these people. But still, through all of that, you do really, at the end of the day, you get, which is rare for a Christopher Nolan movie, you have a sense of hope.
Yes, for sure. There's a real sense of uplift. And I think he finds that, and I think this is why the story is a liberating one for him, because he's not in charge of the ending. It's
right.
It's something that's been given to him, and he really, he finds freedom in telling the story in a very visual way. This is not a movie that's driven by the usual Hollywood three-act structure, character arcs, and so forth. It would almost be fair to say that there are no characters in this movie. I think Mark Rylance is kind of a character. Everyone else is barely a type. And that's not a bad thing. You know, your movie doesn't have to have characters and character development. There are all kinds of ways of telling a story. And this one tells a story through images, through visuals. A lot of times you can't even understand the dialogue. And Nolan knows that, and that's intentional. This is meant to be a visual and a visceral experience rather than, you know, a kind of a filmed screenplay, as it were.
Yeah. And I thought, I think that there's a reason that he was attracted to this. I mean, nobody held a gun to his head and said, you have to make a film about Dunkirk. I think that there's a sense in which he needed to make this film about Dunkirk because he's made movies about, you know, the Joker, you know, one of the most horrific characters ever created for film. There's something so terrifying about the nihilism of the Joker.
Absolutely.
And you know, it's where that character needed to go. I personally have a suspicion that that character helped to kill Heath Ledger. You can't live in that head for that long and not have it do something to you, you know. But yeah, I think he needed to make this film about this story. He could have made any film about any story, but he chose this one, and I think he did it for a reason. And he made a great movie. So who what's your number two and your number one? And then I think we're just about out of time.
Yes. So my number two film is a movie called Mudbound. It is a historical drama set in 1940s Mississippi under Jim Crow, and it concerns two families, a black family and a white family, who are obviously they're divided by race, but they're united by geography, by land, and by circumstance. And it's based on a novel, award-winning novel by Hilary Jordan, and it is a really richly textured narrative, very, very big and emotional story that explores attitudes about marriage and race and culture, and even there are elements of religion in there. You have two of the men from these families each go off to war, to World War II, and when they come back, they have this additional bond of being veterans, and yet there's still the race issue, and it goes in some very interesting places. It's a movie that manages to be epic in scope and yet intimate with its characters, and very, very powerful film directed by Dee Rees. And then my number one film is a Romanian film. It's by one of the best known filmmakers of the Romanian New Wave, Cristian Mungiu, who a bunch of years ago did a movie called 4 Months, 3 Weeks, and 2 Days, abortion-themed drama that was also one of my top 10 for that year. Very, very difficult film to watch. This movie is called Graduation, and like many films in Romania these days, it deals with the problems in Romanian societies, and in particular, he deals with the issue of corruption in the life of a successful doctor who he's cheating on his wife. He is successful in his job, but he wants something more for his talented daughter who's graduating from high school and she has the potential to go into college in the UK and to get out of Romania. And what is he willing to do to get her there? And unfair things happen. And so the movie really explores the kind of insidiousness of corruption and cheating and how making compromises in one area of your life makes it easier to make them in another. And then integrity and honesty are possible, but there's a cost. And are you willing to pay that cost? And so Graduation is about these. So these are my top three films: Graduation by Cristian Mungiu, Mudbound by Dee Rees, and Dunkirk by Christopher Nolan.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Steve. We will have you back, I'm sure, at some future point. And I want to wish you a happy new year and all of your clan. And I want to thank all of you guys out there in Radio Land for listening. And we will be back again soon with John Farrell. We're going to be talking about magic and the magical approach to life and the its relationship to the sciences and the Catholic tradition. But that'll be next time. This time, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.